Good morning. I will call the Civil Law Data Practices Committee to order. We have a couple of things to do this morning before we get started on bills, and that's repair some minutes from the past that we inadvertently left out Representative Ray Dean. He was present and accounted for. Well, he's present, but really not accounted for, so according to the minutes. So, it's nothing personal, as I told him.
It's fine. I'm not running for mayor.
Okay, very good. Well, I think what we'll do then is we'll take up the minutes of March 6th and March 8th. March 6th, were those repaired then? Let's see. Yes. And, okay, you're on both March 6th and March 8th. So we'll take up March 6th first. All those in favor of passage of the minutes from March 6th as amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Those are adopted. March 8th, same thing. Representative Howe makes a motion to pass the minutes of March 8th. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Those are finished, too. The first order of business this morning will be to finish House File testimony on House File 3259, which is my bill on the audits for license plate readers and body cameras. And we had Brian Mueller from Washington County Sheriff's Office, who was on the list, and he is not going to be here to testify. So we only have one testifier remaining, and that's Ms. Christensen from IPAD, or the Data Practices Office, I guess it is. No call. And Mr. Neumeister is here and would like to testify as well. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Stacey Christensen. I'm with the Data Practices Office in the Department of Administration, formerly known as IPAD. And I want to start by thanking Chair Scott for proposing the needed clarifications related to the ALPR data requirements. First, the bill provides for needed clarification by including a date certain when the audits are due. Under current statutory language, the due dates of the audits has been a frequent question we've received and has been a difficult one to answer. Second, the bill offers clarification around who the law enforcement agency must hire to do the audit. We also received questions about what an independent audit meant and couldn't always provide a complete answer. Finally, the bill offers clarification on what information the audit report must include. Admin has also received frequent questions from auditors regarding what needed to be included in the scope of the audit. The new language provides standards and guidance around specific requirements. We do, however, have some concerns about the bill. My testimony today isn't new. I offered similar comments when this legislation was first enacted in 2015, and I'll reiterate those concerns today. The Department of Administration, the Data Practices Office, does not have staff that are auditors. We do not have expertise in auditing or audit review, particularly with expertise in the functions of ALPR and body camera systems. As such, we are currently ill-suited to perform audit review functions and answer questions related to auditing requirements. The increased clarity in the bill magnifies our concerns by presumably requiring an even more active and rigorous review function than under current law. In the absence of adequate expertise or the enhanced staff capacity needed, we have tried to answer questions as best we can, consistent with Section 13.824 for ALPR data. We've received many questions from auditors, potential auditors, and law enforcement agency staff about the biennial audit requirements. While we're able to answer the data practices questions, we do not have the expertise to answer the varying audit questions. And the bulk of the questions that we have received do relate to the auditing obligations rather than data practices requirements. Our preference certainly would be to have the bandwidth and expertise needed to provide the high level of customer service and technical expertise that our customers are accustomed to receiving from the Data Practices Office. The bill also adds body camera audit review responsibility on top of the ALPR audit reviews. We share all the same lack of resources and staff expertise concerns with the body camera language as we do with ALPR. Additionally, while the bill provides some clarification related to the biennial audits, there remains a lack of clarity related to the commissioner's duties. First, on lines 3.12 to 3.15 and 5.25 to 5.28, it is unclear what standard the commissioner is to rely upon in determining whether an agency is not complying with this section or other applicable law in ordering a law enforcement agency to arrange for additional audits. Second, it remains unclear what standard the commissioner is to use in determining whether there is a pattern of substantial noncompliance with this section related to the use of ALPR and body cams. In closing, we respectfully request an opportunity to prepare a fiscal note from our agency in the Data Practices Office. We greatly appreciate the effort to clarify the law, and we welcome an opportunity to work with the chair and others as this legislation moves forward. Thank you for allowing me to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any member questions? Ms. Christensen, thanks for being here this morning. I, you know, we have met on this, and you know, we're willing to make some additional adjustments. I do think with this new language, it's going to make your job a lot easier in interpreting the audits, and I think it's going to make it a lot clearer to the people that are performing the audits what's expected of them as well. And so I think that this bill is definitely a step in the right direction. You know, this was the first time around for this audit cycle. Adding the language on the body cams, I think, will help them as well as, you know, when they're getting ready to do their first-time audits. It'll help them, you know, I think it'll make it a lot easier on your office because we're clarifying the language and people are going to understand what's expected. And one of the things that I requested when we met this last time was a full itemized budget from your office. And I've not received that yet. And I do understand, you know, your office gets $1 million a biennium for four people. And the overall budget is, what, $46 million for the Department of Administration? $48 million. And so I don't see that being, I believe that you're well-funded to pick up any slack that you might need to. And I really do think with the clarifications and language that it's going to be helpful in what's expected of your office. And with that, any other member questions? Is there anyone in the audience? Oh, Mr. Neumeister, thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'm a privacy and open government advocate. It's a pleasure. My inaugural testimony. I'm not as active as I used to be and not live down here like I used to, but every once in a while when a bill comes its way, I like to give my 2 cents. So thank you for my first time before your committee this year. I'd like to bring your attention to page 4, starting with lines 412 through 430, and particularly on lines 420. I support the provision that suggests that reasonable suspicion must be a standard for law enforcement to internally review body cam videos. Now, let me tell you a little bit about my background. I was in the front of the body cam debate two years ago, and it was going all over different places. Right after the law was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor, and before a lot of body cam video became private or not available to the public, I asked for hours of body cam videos. And I got hours of body cam videos. After the law was implemented over the last year, I've been going to various departments asking for body cam videos, and I've been getting body cam videos in those situations where by law you're able to, or with the consent of the subject. And what do I see? I see where we, the government, are collecting information on people in a lot of situations when they're most vulnerable, particularly in their homes, where law enforcement is collecting thousands and thousands of hours of body cam videos that are never prosecuted for, never used for prosecution, never used for anything, but used for maybe something down the line. Oh, were we at 473 Fifth Street year and a half ago? Well, there's possibilities of that might be a nuisance house. Huh? Did we have a call there?
Yes.
Well, how many officers went to there? Well, we had four officers who all had body cams. Some of the things that I see over the last 2 years looking at body cam videos is that they all come from different viewpoints depending on the officer, and they tell you different things. And I just wanted to leave with a comment, and then I'll make my last statement. This is something I wrote 2 years ago in the midst of the debate, the body cam debate, and still it's strong with me today. The law enforcement agency can do almost whatever it wants to do with the body camera video collected and stored. Once it's collected and stored for themselves. For example, when an officer enters your home with a body camera, it collects and gathers a great amount of government data. What magazines you read, which are on your table, the way you live, the food you may eat, which is on the kitchen counter, are among the details it captures. The role of a body camera is to file and save for another time, not to rely on the human eye and memory, but to rewind and enhance the digital film to really see what is going on in your home, all done at that time without your specific consent to film or possible knowledge of the camera. So we already settled the consent issue. The legislature said, really, no consent. An officer comes in. But there is one protection, and rather than where thousands and thousands of hours of body cam videos are held in the repository of law enforcement that may not ever be used for prosecution of a crime or are held for so many years because that's what the retention schedule is, should not be able to be used without a reasonable suspicion. Now, as you know, there was discussion about a warrant. There was all kinds of discussion in past years about what do you do with this kind of information, LPR or whatever. But I think reasonable suspicion is an appropriate standard. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I very strongly urge you that part. Now, the other aspects of this section I think is important, 4.24 through 4.30. It's very clear. You want to know enhanced role. And this is very similar language or the same language that's with LPRs. Again, what has always happened, and I encourage you, at least I'm, this is my knowledge, the Privacy Commission, which is bipartisan also, has supported this. So it's not coming out of somewhere. It's coming with a commission that you have suggested look at some of these issues, and this is one of the issues that they did look at. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is my point of view, and I know there's opposition to the reasonable suspicion, but you have to take a look. We're in new territories with technologies, and law enforcement has a lot more kind of stuff on us than ever had before, particularly with body cam videos. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I do just want to clear the record, too, that the Data Commission didn't take up the portion that kind of set a standard for both body cams and the ALPRs. I later made the decision that since we're taking this subject up, that we should align the language in both policies so that they would be similar. And I have spoken with law enforcement on the reasonable suspicion piece, and while I agree with it in most cases, I think there are cases, I mean, one of the things we want them to use the body cam video for is training purposes. And so I see the value in that. But I appreciate your testimony. If you want to respond to that, you can. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I think you can still keep the reasonable standard and still make that exception. Yeah, I mean, language is important in legislation, and you can always work things out. And it's one of those things as I get older, that's why I'm not here as much, because I can do a lot of things like just by talking with people, phone calls, and thank God for technology, even though I didn't like computers. I was one of the last of the folks to get one of those. But I think that could be worked out if you and your colleagues support you in this kind of concept. particularly with the new technology of body cam videos.
Okay, thank you. Are there member questions? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I guess I didn't move the bill before the committee, which I thought I did. But anyway, I will move House File 3259 before the committee. And the motion would be that it be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. So now I would renew my motion that happen. And all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way to public safety. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1719, Representative Whalen. Members, there is a technical amendment that was submitted after the deadline, and it's the pages are going to be supplying that to us right now. Representative Whalen, would you like to move House File 1719, and the motion would be that it be re-referred to public safety?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would. Thank you.
Okay. And you do have a DE2, so let's take that up first.
I do. I have a DE2 amendment, Madam Chair, and then the A2 to the DE2.
Okay.
As you stated, Madam Chair, the A2 is mostly technical in nature. There was drafting error, something we overlooked. It also adds an effective date for one part of the bill. And then the DE2 makes some changes that came as a result of pretty extensive conversations, and I can share. We can either move it to get the bill in the shape I'd like,
sure.
Or I can share more about that.
All right. Representative Lesh, have you seen the technical amendment?
I have, Your Honor.
Oh, thank you.
Sometimes it's tough to switch from court to legislature. So, Madam Chair, rather than Your Honor. Yes, I have talked with folks. There has been a lot of language that I think Representative Whalen has worked with. I have no objection to the new language and think it's a good compromise.
All right, very good. So we'll take up the DE2 first, and then we'll... Okay, we're taking up the A2 first. All those in favor of adoption of the A2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A2 is adopted. Now to the DE2. All those in favor of the DE2, adoption of the DE2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The DE2 is adopted, and the bill should be in the form that you'd like. Representative Whalen, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing the bill today. As I mentioned, the DE2 is the result of a lot of collaboration. When I originally introduced the bill, I thought all we needed was a simple change. I now realize I don't think there is such a thing in the area of family law. I met with Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid and a few other lawyers, and learned the change that we wanted to make had many implications, but thankfully that Melinda and other experts in this area agreed with the premise of the bill and that we could make improvements to the current statute. So I do want to acknowledge many folks have been working in this area for a long time, many on this committee, and my bill isn't a fix to everything, but I do think it's a step in the right direction to bring some clarity to our laws. And I'll let my testifier share on the specifics, but the DE2, in essence, gets to a conflict in statute that, if you'll note your handout in the packet, I'd like to point out to you. Currently, there's a conflict regarding when someone may bring an action to challenge an existing recognition of paternity. If you'll see on the table in your packet, row 1, column 1, under paternity presumptions, if the child's mother and presumed father are married after the child is born and the presumed father consented to be listed on the birth record, to declare non-existence of paternity, the person bringing the action has 2 years, but no more than 3 after the child is born. In the case of my constituent who brought this issue to my attention, the child was over 3 years. However, there's another portion of statute, if you look in the third row, first column, that states when the mother and presumed father have executed a recognition of paternity, but there is another man with a presumption of paternity. To declare non-existence, an action must be brought within 6 months of blood or genetic testing, showing that the presumed father is not the father, which my constituent also fell into this category. And while I'll let my testifier share a little bit more on this and the details of their case, my understanding was they had an incredibly challenging time finding a lawyer who would take their case because of this confusion in our statutes. So in sum, I know that when an issue, when this issue is presented to me, it seemed there was definitely room for improvement, and that's the intent of the bill. While it makes a variety of other changes, in essence, it seeks to get to that conflict, and it says that if you are not the biological father of a child you had thought you were the biological father of, and you do need clear and convincing evidence, like a genetic test to show this, you can bring a suit forward to challenge the recognition of paternity that you had signed, as long as you do so within 3 years of having reason to believe you're not the biological father. Members, as I just shared, there's some different timelines regarding different situations of when you can bring these suits, and one is the six-month timeline for genetic testing. Although even that lawyer, I've come to realize even under that, lawyers have a disagreements of how to interpret that. But personally, I don't think that's enough time to get over that shock if you learn. If you thought you were a child was your own and you learn by genetic test they're not, that is incredibly traumatic, I would imagine, and it takes some time to work through those emotions and what you would like to do with that information. While ideally I would like to just have our statute say simply, if you're the biological father, you are on that recognition of paternity, and if you're not, you're not. I also realize just doing that had many implications in our laws and touched many other things. So we felt the three-year timeline was a fair meeting in the middle, if you will. You have 3 years to decide to act, and if you don't act within that time, then the court will just consider that you've known for 3 years and you had time to act. So this bill also, just to highlight a couple other things, establishes some factors that the court must consider in cases that challenge paternity. The petitioner must show by clear and convincing evidence, after these factors are considered, that declaring the non-existence of the father-child relationship is in the child's best interest, and that's lines 4.4 to 4.6, which I think is one of the best things we can do. We always want to make sure we're looking after the child's best interests. And with that, I want to invite up my testifier, Melinda Hugdahl, from Legal Aid, to share on the specifics of the bill and to walk through, especially if members have questions on some of the technical pieces. But just in closing, you know, members, I know life's not fair. And sadly, we live in a fallen world, and when one finds out they're not the biological father of the child they thought was theirs, that has a lot of implications. We know infidelity being one can lead to divorce, can lead to child custody cases. I've had my own experience with divorce in my family. It's painful. And so I think we need to do whatever we can do to make improvements in our statutes so that we can ensure the best outcomes for these families and for the children. And so when this case was brought to my attention, I thought, this is something we can do to make an improvement. And so I'd ask for your support. And with that, again, I'd like to invite up Melinda Hugdahl. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Whelan. She's motioning to the other witnesses.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If it would please the committee, however you'd like to have them present, I can have my constituent who's actually experienced this case, their son, come and testify.
Sure, let's hear from them. Please come, and you may need to grab another chair there, and so that there are two. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue on with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. My name is Mark Barrett. I am the father of Benjamin Barrett, who is the constituent that named in this motion that was not able to be here this morning because of work conflict and the need to pay his child support.
I'm Marilyn Barrett. I'm the mother of the constituent.
Okay, perfect. Mr. Barrett, go ahead. If you're the one that's going to be speaking mostly, go ahead.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I'll try to be brief in a very involved story, and sometimes I get a little verbose. Our son was dating a young woman, and during that time of dating, she became pregnant. We were told that he was told by both the child's mother and the woman's mother that our son was the father of that child, and it was presumed at that point that we acknowledged that he was the parent. As such, we took the mother in her mother kicked her out of her house. I didn't want her living in a car for my grandson at that time, and so we took her into our basement on a limited time, saying that you need to find residence, but at least to get you through the delivery. She actually had the child while living in our home that we provided for her, under the presumption that my son was the father. Subsequent to that, they married. And after the child was born, and again, all along presuming, and we're told that she told him, and we told us that Sean indeed was our grandson, and Ben was the father. Subsequent to that, there became some personal issues, and my son and her divorced. At which time, during the proceedings, discussion of custody or visitation, and then it became apparent that at the same kind of almost simultaneously that the gentleman who was later described as being the biological father, who had been in the Navy, returned home, said, "I want to be involved in the child's life," and so there were subsequent a lot of things happening somewhat simultaneously, we were threatened that if indeed at the time of the dissolution that indeed that if or in thereabouts the timeline floats a little bit, that if indeed my son took his name off the birth certificate, that all of his visitation rights and our visitation rights, according to the mother, would cease, that she would refuse visitation. Subsequent to that, we went forward and tried to get at first there was an amiable agreement of how it would proceed, but then the mother decided that it would be in her best interest to receive child support, so went after my son and all. For that, and that's when the discussion came as far as, again, further discussion as far as custody. It was described to us that the biological father had a paternity test that he purchased at CVW Pharmacy and had it tested. We don't know. We've never seen that test. My son has never seen that test. It's only hearsay as far as at this point. As this proceeded and we attempted to get lawyers to take the case, as Representative Whalen has described, we had contacted several lawyers, some of them personal friends, who said that they wouldn't touch the case because there was just too many conflicting points of law for them to even entertain it as well. In the process, we came and my son decided to, under counsel, to decided to have a paternity test to prove that he was not the biological father, which he did, and that indeed showed that he was not the biological father under a revisitation of the to the court, Judge Street of Anoka County presiding. The court ordered, or the county ordered, that he had another test done. Again, his test was done at a certified laboratory. They demanded that he have a test done at a certified laboratory. He repeated the test, again proving that he was not the biological father. And so at this point, he is required by ruling, according to Judge Street, as even as recent as yesterday, but a week ago, Monday, at a hearing, a motion hearing before Judge Street, that he continued to pay child support as well as child support in the arrears that had been suspended since November, when a lot of this motion or the motions to reinstate the case or whatever had come about, and that we were moving forward and seeking to try and get a determination. In light of all of that, I think it's salient to understand that, again, when we talk about Sean and Sean's best interest, we love Sean. Well, and we love him dearly. We love him as he bears my last name, El Barrett. And I want the best for Sean. But as I see right now, he has my son, a non-biological father who he calls daddy. He has a biological father that who got married, was in his biological father's wedding. The biological parent and father and his wife have a room in their home that they've set aside. Anytime Sean comes to stay, he has his own room, his own toys. They have visitation at Christmas, Thanksgiving, other major holidays, that as much as they can. So Sean sees that as a non-biological father. I don't know. I think he calls him Brandon by his first name. He does not call him daddy. Thirdly, Brianna has remarried. So Sean has a third parent, male parent, that is not biological father nor daddy to him. And I don't know his name. But so to me, how traumatic that a child has not only multiple adult fathers or multiple adult male parents, is a better way to put that, as well as multiple grandparents. To me, that's just incredible confusion. And we would like, again, very traumatic for us in this whole process of even trying to, just the other day, trying to work out, well, I'll drop off Sean here and you can pick him up there and everything, and I digress, I'm sorry. But that is essentially the nature of our story. Marilyn, do you want to add anything to that or amend anything? I have a tendency not to always... So
it's okay.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. It's a very difficult story. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to state something that I was going to state originally in my comments, too. And thank you for sharing your story. I think it just highlights the complex nature of family law in general. This case is a specific case, but there are many like it where there are so many different aspects to it, and our laws currently don't cover everything perfectly. I don't know that they can, but we're trying to make an improvement. And so while this bill, if my bill actually passed today, it would not necessarily help Ben currently. But do you know, he said to me he wants to help people that could find themselves in a situation similar to his in the future. And so that's why I'm bringing the bill forward. And while I do think there is still some way that Ben's case could be resolved, I wanted to note that. And Madam Chair, thank you. And I'm happy to stand for questions, but I'm also happy to have Melinda Hugdell now come from Legal Aid to walk through the bill.
Were there any questions from members for these testifiers? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony, for being here to tell your story.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hugdell. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. I'm Melinda Hugdell from Legal Aid. Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank Representative Whalen, too. We originally talked to her about this bill last year when it was introduced. The introduced version we had some concerns about simply because we've seen, unfortunately, a lot of these cases, and they're really traumatic on kids when people who have been a legal father bring an action to no longer be the father. So as Representative Whalen has pointed out, we have currently two different ways we handle these types of cases. If you're married, there is a bar after the child is 3 years old. If you sign a recognition, you have at any point in the child's age, as long as it's within 6 months of the genetic test being done. So we have cases, especially in the recognition side, where we have 10- and 12-year-old kids or older who find out that their father's not their father, and that's incredibly traumatic. So we were concerned with opening that door to the same standard as it was in the original bill. So I want to thank Representative Whalen for being really open to our input and our technical assistance. My folks at Legal Aid have reviewed this. They're fine with it. So I think I'll just kind of give a very high-level overview. This is a really complex area of law. I kind of tell people it's like a Jenga tower. If you start kind of moving too many blocks, you really start doing things you don't intend. I did just want to make one comment about the amendment, the technical amendment of the effective date. With the recognition of parentage, when people sign them now, they have a right to bring an action to disestablish as long as it's within 6 months of their genetic test. And so in trying to kind of line up all of these timelines, we had to think about the effective date so that we wouldn't change someone's rights that they had when they signed the recognition. So that's why we had to make a special provision for the effective date, just so that's clear. So it'll apply to recognition signed on or after August 1st, so that people who have signed them now knew what they were signing, and that effective date will carry through for them. So just a clarification of why that is the way it is. So current law has those different standards that we look at. We also don't have any factors really that look at the impact of these cases on the child, and we thought that was a concern under current law, and this gave us an opportunity to really fit those pieces together much better. We also tried to look at the fact that in child protection cases, we don't allow parents to bring up private, what they call private termination of parental rights, which is to say privately, there's no other grounds going on. They just want to come in and say, I'm not the parent. We only allow those if there's a step-parent adoption happening at the same time. So we tried to kind of, as best we can, make them match better than they currently do. There are some limits to that, but that was kind of the attempt. So generally, as Representative Whalen indicated, this puts in a three-year limit to bring a claim 3 years from when they knew, should have known they were the father. We did draw a little bit of a line between contested and default cases because contested cases, you have been there and litigated some of these issues. Defaults, you haven't. They're looked at a little differently. So we did have a little bit of a distinction there. If you had a contested case that you were in court already on this, your timeline is, your hurdle's a little bit higher with fraud, mistake, and duress of fact. Sorry, I can't talk this morning. Fraud, duress, and mistake of fact. So it's really a balance between some reasonable time to bring these claims, looking at the impact on children. We don't want them to just keep getting older and older and older before these cases come forward, and also looking at finality of court orders, which we have to recognize too. So in general, what happens is that you have to show the court, first of all, that you're within the time limits to bring the action. Generally speaking, that's 3 years. So unless you had a default case, when you're within that 3 years, you have to show the court that there was fraud, duress, or mistake of fact or surprise. So that's kind of the first door you have to get in. After that, you have to show that the disestablishment is in the child's best interest, and that's where those factors come in. And the factors are in the bill. It's really looking at how old is the child, what's the relationship between the parent who wants to have that relationship disestablished, how did that come about, all those factors. So those are new things that will look at those pieces. It also looks at the likelihood of another man being adjudicated as the father. In some of these cases, like the case you heard about, the biological father is known. In some of them, they're not. They find out they're not the father, there is no one else, and they want to bring their action. So we're trying to kind of, again, balance all these different ways that people can come to this. And after that, if the court looks at these factors, they can decide whether or not they want to grant the action. The one exception to this with the factors, by the way, deals with the recognition of parentage, because if you're not the biological father on a recognition, they have to vacate it. So we tried to kind of pair that up with giving the courts the ability, however, to adjudicate that person as the father if another presumption applied. So, for example, a child is 12 years old, and the person finds out they're not the biological parent. They bring their action in the right timeline. If their biological test says zero, the court has to vacate the recognition. But if that person's been holding the child out for 12 years, they can adjudicate them as the father on the basis that they've held out the child as their own. If there's another father, the biological father who's joined, then the court would look at both of those fathers and weigh them under current law under what we call competing presumptions. So at that point, if the court is looking at granting the request to disestablish paternity, we have to make certain that there's certain situations don't exist so that we don't have conflicts. They have to make sure the genetic testing was properly concluded, again, so we have things that are certified by a lab, which is our requirement under existing law. We have to make sure the child hasn't been adopted, that the man seeking disestablishment didn't act to prevent the biological father from coming forward, or that they didn't know at the time that they weren't the father and legally consented to it. And that's in cases, we have a very limited ground in Minnesota about, for example, artificial insemination, and that's at the time people legally acknowledging and consenting under the law that they are not the biological parent, but they're going to be recognized as the parent. So those cases shouldn't apply. This statute shouldn't apply to them. That's not the intent, is to give people a second chance. It's for people who didn't know they were the father at the time these decisions were made. So if all of those are met, the court can grant it, and the order will end that parent-child relationship. It removes the father's name from the birth certificate. It does end the ongoing obligation to pay child support. The unpaid arrears, parties can make agreements under existing law to waive those. The court can't force people to give up child support owed to them under federal law. So they will end the ongoing obligation, and unless the parties reach an agreement, the arrears will remain on the books. That there's no reimbursement that's going to happen between people who might be adjudicated and disestablished within the same action. And if they adjudicate someone else, they have to make sure that we cover all the pieces of adjudicating a new father, the child's name and what the custody and parenting time and the child support of the newly adjudicated father will be, because we're going to have cases where these will be combined actions, where someone is saying, I'm not the father, and they bring in the person who is the biological father, and they're doing it all in one case. So that is a really general overview of the bill. I'm happy to answer questions. I think, as you've heard, these cases can get incredibly complicated. So the bill, we tried to cover a lot of different ways this can happen. So I'm happy to answer questions, but I'm afraid if I get too much in the weeds, we'll just get maybe too in the weeds.
Yeah, I understand. Thank you for that explanation. Are there any member questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Whalen renews her motion that House File 1719 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The next file before us will be House File 3032, Representative Lehman. Representative Vogel, would you like to move House File 3032? And the motion would be that it would be going to the GovOps Committee.
Yes, I would.
Okay, has been moved. Right. Welcome to the committee, Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm pleased to be here. I'm Representative Sandy Lehman. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm here with Matt Patton to talk about LIFT. But before I get going, I'd like to offer an amendment to the bill.
And the amendment is entitled the A3, I believe.
Yes. And this amendment simply clarifies in the bill that, it's just a clarifying statement of something that was already included in the bill, but the language maybe wasn't so clear.
Okay. Very well. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for doing the A3 amendment. Members, I brought up this issue in the Commerce Commission, Commerce Committee, sorry. The bill previously said sex offenders that are on the federal registry, and this clarifies that also Minnesota-registered sex offenders that aren't on the federal registry are prohibited.
Thank you for that. I will move the A3 so that we can get the bill in the shape that the author wishes. All those in favor of adoption of the A3, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A3 is amended on to House File 3032. Representative Lehman, to your bill.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm here to talk about House File number 3032. And what the bill is a bill to what I see is a bill to help bring Lyft to the suburbs and to greater Minnesota to make it an easier transition for Lyft and other companies like Lyft to do business in Minnesota. Lyft has been here since about 2014 in the state of Minnesota. Since that time, hundreds and thousands of us have had the opportunity to use the services. It's a driving on demand, and I have found it to be very convenient, very safe, very customer friendly. And as a person who lives 4 hours north of St. Paul, I can see where this would be a great benefit to greater Minnesota with our senior population, with our disabled population, even with our tourists in the area. To have an opportunity like this available to them would be a benefit for quality of life purposes, for economic development purposes, and so on. Just a couple of statistics that I found were interesting is that 90% of the drivers for Lyft are employed or retired. Many of them are self-employed. So these are people who are not driving for Lyft full-time, at least 90% of them. They have other jobs, and they are using this for extra income. And then 46% of passengers use their car less because of Lyft. And I think we're all interested in having people driving safely, whether it's they've had a couple of drinks with dinner or what have you. The Lyft service, I think, is keeping our roads safer and maybe with a little less traffic. So with that, that's why I'm here today, and that's why I'm really enthusiastic about the bill. And I would like to have Mr. Patton go into a little more detail on the bill.
Thank you for being here this morning. State your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Sure. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you all for considering this bill. My name is Matt Patton. I'm the Midwest Public Policy Manager for Lyft. We're the first company to establish peer-to-peer on-demand ride-sharing in 2014. Today, we're the fastest ride-sharing company in the United States. We're more than just a safe ride to work, home, or doctor appointment. Our service allows people to be their own boss, give them flexibility in their schedule, and the opportunity to earn supplemental income. The bill before you codifies much of what we do already across the state into law in order to avoid a patchwork of inconsistent regulations, and more importantly, so we can bring more services into your state. Lyft's number one priority is safety. Our drivers are extensively pre-screened, have passed the thorough driver record review, in addition to having their vehicle pass a comprehensive vehicle inspection. That focus on safety and security continues throughout the Lyft experience. Every ride is protected by Lyft's $1.5 million commercial automobile liability coverage, which protects riders and drivers throughout the ride. No privacy is paramount to this committee, and Lyft shares your focus on it. In order to protect the privacy of our users and drivers, we require valid and sufficient legal process before we can disclose business records regarding users or trips in response to law enforcement requests, and all data retention and destruction policies determining compliance with applicable laws. Maintaining trust of our passengers and our drivers is fundamental to Lyft. Our data is protected from inappropriate external access by a variety of features. We're constantly evaluating our security measures to improve security. Without a uniform statewide regulation, like the one before you today, a patchwork of local regulations stands as a barrier for drivers and riders who otherwise could be sharing a ride to work from their home in the suburbs to their office in the Twin Cities. Already, Lyft rides have generated an estimated $26 million into Minnesota's economy. 45 other states have passed similar bills that work in compliance with federal and applicable state laws. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for keeping it to just the reasons that this bill is here today, which is the background checks and Section 3, Subdivision 11. Let's go through all of the testimony first, and then we'll go to member questions. The next person I have, the gentleman to your left, is he prepared to testify?
Madam Chair, members, I just wanted to address the background check issue, if I may.
Sure.
My name is Bill Griffith, representing Lyft. We've met with Representative Hillstrom and others. We want to clarify that the intent of the bill is to be as strict or more strict than local ordinances. We looked at six local ordinances that are essentially in law today at the local level. There are a few gaps, and it's our interest to fill those gaps. So we don't want to be any less strict than the ordinances that are effective today. And, in fact, in some cases we'll be stricter because our look back is 7 years on serious crime rather than five. So it's our intent to be consistent and stricter than local ordinances.
I will allow one member question because Representative Hillstrom did speak with me before the committee started about this background check issue, so I will allow that question. Go ahead.
Thank you. Well, Madam Chair, I guess one of the questions that I have, so if it's your intention to be as strict, you're not right now.
Correct.
And so we specifically talked about misdemeanor convictions and gross misdemeanor convictions in my office. And the gaps that are there. And we hadn't yet talked about Representative Grossel has concerns with stays of adjudication. When people get sex offense convictions, they're not convictions, they're stays of adjudication. If the word is conviction in your bill, it doesn't include any of those people. And so, Madam Chair, I guess then the real question would be for you, if the intention is they want to make them at least as strict as current law, what is it you're intending to do? Are you going to pass a background check bill that's not done, or are you intending? What is your intention? Going to make them fix it before you send it on? Or?
Right. I think we'll see how the rest of the committee goes before I make that decision.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll have some other questions after I hear from the other testifiers, if that's okay. If
sure,
we can
absolutely.
Go through each and every one of them. Thanks.
Yep. Very well. Thank you for being here. The first or the next testifier is Ann Fine with the League of Minnesota Cities, and on deck is Ricardo Cervantes.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ann Finn, and I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. I will be very brief. I want to clarify one thing that's been presented earlier, and that is that we need this new law in order to bring service to greater Minnesota and other underserved communities. And nothing in current statute actually prohibits services from operating outside of the cities that have enacted ordinances. So, for example, I live in Minnetonka and I've accessed the service. My city does not have an ordinance. The League of Minnesota Cities opposes House File 3032 because it interferes with local decision-making authority. And we believe that the cities that have enacted ordinances have done so in a very careful and deliberate way in consultation with the providers. Given the significance of this public policy change, we think a logical next step would be to convene a stakeholder working group to develop some consensus around some of the measures in the bill. The League of Minnesota Cities is committed to participating, if not convening, a group of stakeholders to start working through some of the issues that have been presented. And with that, I will stop and take any questions.
All right. Please stick by closely in case we have member questions at the end.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Cervantes, I don't know if I'm butchering that or not, but welcome to the committee. On deck is Mr. Sonbol with the Blue and White Taxi. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, that was the correct pronunciation, and thank you for having me. Members of the committee, again, my name is Ricardo Cervantes. I'm the director of the Department of Safety and Inspections with the City of St. Paul. St. Paul is always interested in looking at new and innovative ways of improving services and supporting a vibrant, strong business community. The Department of Safety and Inspections is charged with protecting the health and safety of its residents and visitors. As previously mentioned by Ann, in 2013 and 14, St. Paul worked in cooperation with several metro cities, the Metropolitan Airports Commission, the Met Council, and even the State of Minnesota State Reps, as well as the TNC industry, to enact a thorough and well-thought-out, fair, reasonable, and effective ordinance that provides protection for passengers and drivers of the TNC industry. These laws have been developed into practices that have proven effective for the City of St. Paul. Prior to the hearing today, we did have an opportunity to meet with Lyft representatives and discuss House File 3032, and we had an opportunity to weigh in on that bill as well as voice our concerns. During our review of the bill, it became apparent that we needed to better understand how the state is prepared to implement and administer these new laws. The bill does not contain specific language as to who will be responsible to ensure compliance of the bill's regulations. What enforcement tools or systems will be in place to gain compliance, or how the state will appropriately fund the administration of these regulations. In addition to these larger questions, we have concerns regarding the language in the bill that diminish the safety and creates an unfair competitive advantage for TNCs. As pointed out by Representative Hillstrom, we have issues with the proposed language around the criminal background check. The way it's currently written would actually allow for someone still serving a sentence or possibly even being incarcerated to apply and qualify to be a driver for TNC. The proposed language provides vague vehicle inspection requirements and establishes no standard. By comparison, we had heard that we would want regulations to be tough as local ordinances. We actually do annual inspections of vehicles to ensure that they are safe. And then limiting licensing fees would inadequately resource the state and would eliminate staffing necessary to conduct the compliance checks. Preempting local regulations of TNCs and implementing the proposed bill would create an unfair competitive advantage for TNCs over their primary competitors. Under the proposed bill, the regulatory cost for a TNC vehicle would be approximately $1 per vehicle. We estimate that there's well over 10,000 vehicles operating in the metro area. By comparison, St. Paul charges $420 for a cab license, and the state charges $80 for a limousine license. Finally, this bill has no mileage or age limits for TNC vehicles, which would further disadvantage taxi cab operators as well as jeopardize public safety. The City of St. Paul has serious concerns with the bill and believes there are other ways to gain regulatory uniformity. As proposed, City of St. Paul would be interested in working with a group to come up with a more unified set of regulations around the TNC, and would be interested in moving in that direction.
Thank you for your testimony. Please stick around in case members have questions later. Next, Mr. Sunbull, and our final testifier that's on my list anyway will be Allison Grubner. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Good morning. My name is Waleed Sunbull. I am the general manager of Blue and White Taxi. We serve the 7-county metro area with 303 cars, 347 drivers. I'd like to echo that there is nothing that restricts or no laws that restrict us from serving beyond the greater metro area. We go to Grand Rapids if we're called. We've gone to Lakeville. We go to Faribault to do pickups. There's no laws that regulate that, so there's nothing that prohibits TNCs from doing it either. I kind of want to address a couple issues here and some legal things I think that need to be considered, because I believe there's great risk in allowing something like this. One of the things actually I'd like to read out really quick are just the terms and conditions for Lyft when they talk about safety. In their app, it says Lyft has no responsibility whatsoever for the actions or conduct of drivers or riders. Responsibility for the decisions you make regarding providing or accepting transportation rests solely with you. Drivers and riders use services at their own risk. A company that's telling you to basically get in their cars and risk the lower standards is not willing to accept the liability of you getting in their cars and accepting those lower standards. Just for convenience sake, Ubers, as you understand, therefore, by using the application service, you may be exposed to transportation that is potentially dangerous, offensive, harmful to minors, unsafe, or otherwise objectionable. So when we talk about the background checks that require strenuous and they claim that they have an industry-leading or just as good, I think it's very important to note out that in the Star and Tribune last year, they found 30% of the 176 drivers they looked at from Uber and Lyft didn't pass Uber and Lyft's own background checks. They were driving. The state of Massachusetts had 8,000 drivers kicked off the TNC platform. 51 of them were sexual offenders, and they weren't allowed to drive anymore. In the city of Chicago a couple of years ago, they found 203 violations of background checks. One of them was a driver who had a federal, who had just gotten out of jail for a federal terrorism charge. And his response was, maybe they should have done a better background check. And he was a Lyft driver. So there are grave concerns by doing that, something like that, including the safety inspection, which I believe, again, you're signing off saying it's okay. Do you really want to put somebody in the car? If I say I want a safe car, do you want a 75-point inspection, which checks brakes, rotors, axles, struts, shocks, or do you want somebody to kick the tires and say, hey, you know what, the seatbelts work. This seems pretty safe for me. I don't think we want that. I don't think it's safe. I don't think the state wants to accept it, the responsibility of it. And then when it comes to the last point is, I believe that a fair level playing field is what we always have asked for. We've never asked you to set what those were. We've never went to Minneapolis and St. Paul and said, let them be us. We've said, look, if you decide, if you believe background checks aren't important, then fine. If you believe that safety inspections aren't important, then fine. If you believe that all the fees that you guys keep on taking from us are not important, then okay. But it's the same industry. No matter what way you put it, no matter what you dress it up, in the end, it is transportation for hire. That's all it is. They lease cars. It is not personal cars 100%. In 24 cities, people can go lease a car through Lyft to drive a Lyft car. So that's not a personal ride share. That's a taxi cab company. In fact, they're more of a cab company than I am because we don't actually lease cars to anybody. So I think it's very important. So if you believe this is the case, then make a level playing field. I'm willing to operate on it. I'm willing to take the chances. I'm willing to upsell my services by doing so. But if regulation is considered the shackle, then trust me, we have been shackled for so long, we're okay without having those shackles too. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And I want to remind the testifiers that we're just here to talk about the background checks and Section 3, which has to do with the data practices piece. Our final testifier is Allison Grubner. Grubner? Thank you for being here this morning. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, members. My name is Allison Grubner. I'm Director of Government Affairs at the Department of Commerce. Thank you for the opportunity to provide a couple of comments on the bill. This bill is a loose framework, which raises a lot of questions that we've discussed with Representative Lehman, Lyft, and we've also shared with the House Commerce Committee. The department believes this bill requires significantly more stakeholder conversations before it moves forward. A couple of the department's concerns on the bill in front of you is that this bill creates a licensing scheme without articulating licensing standards.
Ma'am, if you could keep your comments just to the background checks and Section 3, Subdivision 11. We've got a limited amount of time left. I have two more bills to get to.
Sure.
So if you could just limit it to those comments to those specific areas, that'd be really appreciated. Thank you.
I understand. Thank you. So I guess what I will say is that the bill, the way it's drafted, isn't workable for the Department of Commerce. We cannot actually implement it the way that it is, and we've shared that. And so we look forward to working with folks to bring it to a place where we can support it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yep.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the bill, does it require the Commerce Department to implement these background checks or to make sure that there's compliance with the background checks, or are you the agency that does that, or who would do that in this
bill? Ms. Grubner.
Thank you for the question. So the way the bill is drafted right now, it doesn't articulate that. As the regulatory entity named in the bill, one would presume that Commerce would have that authority, but it's not spelled out specifically.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we will move to member questions. Other member questions for any of the testifiers? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I asked that question because on January 12th of 2018, there was an article in the Colorado newspaper, the Denver Post, excuse me, that said that ride-sharing service Lyft paid the Colorado Public Utilities Commission $224,375 in civil fines to settle allegations that they allowed drivers with serious felonies to transport passengers for more than a year. It goes on to say, you know, who they were and what they did in the article. But I think, one, we need to fix the background checks that are in the bill, but two, we need to be very clear as to who the regulator is. And if there is a failure to comply with their own agreement of whatever those background checks are, we have somebody who has the ability to do it. They found that Colorado slapped Uber with an $8.9 million penalty for allowing 57 people with past criminal or motor vehicle offenses to drive for the company. And the article goes on and on. So I think, one, if you're going to do it, you got to fix the background checks. And we can go through each of those pieces that I think I have a concern about. But two, in the event we do come to agreement on what those background checks should look like, I need to know who is going to be the enforcement mechanism for those background checks.
Very good. Other member questions? I do, Representative Lesh, I guess there is one other person that wished to testify, but Representative Lesh, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that Representative Hillstrom saw this bill before because it was in Commerce and so was vetted about a lot was going on. I honestly, this was first on my radar yesterday afternoon when all of a sudden everyone started coming up and talking to me about it. So I'm a little concerned at this point. Now, when I ran this committee, Madam Chair, I did the same thing you did, which is because House rules say that everything involves data practices have to come to this committee, we would get everything in the legislature coming through here but for the fact that we concentrated on data practices portions. However, we still have to vote on the entire bill. Every member is voting on the entire bill to go out of here. And it feels like to me that this was a bill that the industry put together to run up the flagpole, see who salutes. And I don't know if they already got the skids greased and all your members to vote for this thing. But if that's true, maybe it is true because no one talked to me about it until yesterday afternoon. I'm in the minority. No one needs to worry about my vote if they got all you guys lined up. But if that's true, I'm severely concerned about what Representative Hillstrom talked about. That we're going to be letting sex offenders and other people drive grandma to the airport. And I would hope that we would take a serious pause because if everyone who lined up here to come in to talk about it, say there are all these gaps, I feel like the industry probably should have dotted a few more I's and crossed a few more T's before they even brought it here. I would hope that we would at least lay this over until they dot a few more I's, if not all the T's. So, Madam Chair, I'm gonna move to just lay this over until we get a little bit more assurances that some of those I's have been dotted. I don't know if I'm gonna prevail or not, but we'll see.
Could you hold on until we hear from the testifier,
yeah,
and then
we'll
take
you.
That motion up if that's all right. Steve Huser from Metro Cities. Sorry to leave you out of the loop there. Go ahead.
No problem, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Huser. I represent Metro Cities. Metro Cities represents the shared interests of cities in the 7-county metro area. I'll be very brief. Metro Cities shares a lot of what you've heard from the League of Minnesota Cities in previous testimony. The crux of our opposition to this bill is the sections related to local control, so I know that that's not the purview of this committee. But I did want to make sure that the committee knew that Metro Cities is committed to continue to working on this language, but we do have a lot of concerns, and our members have a lot of concerns with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lucero, then Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just wanted to briefly make a comment. I'm receptive to what Representative Lesh and Representative Hillstrom are bringing up. I'm very much receptive to that. This is a work in progress, but we have to keep in mind that technology is moving at an exponential pace. And this is an emerging industry that is continuing to try to make improvements. But government runs at a snail's pace. It is a behemoth that takes a long time to accomplish almost everything. And so right now we have two forces, the slow pace of government, the rapid pace of technology innovation and emerging industry. And so we have to try to do the best we can to come up with something, because when we hit committee deadlines and or when we adjourn this legislative session, that doesn't mean that technology innovation comes to a stop. It's going to continue to move on throughout the summer and into next year. So I appreciate the work or the comments that they're saying, but we have to do the best we can. And we may not come up with the perfect bill, but we need to advance something and try and wrap our arms around this emerging field and technology, while at the same time then continue the conversation perhaps into or over the summer, and then come back and continue the work next legislative session. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mostly have a clarifying question. So you had stated that this, if it passes, it would be going to government ops. Is this also going to public safety? Because there's a lot of Chapter 609 in here, and it seems like a lot of the concerns, although it is background check, it's a lot of statutory references to criminal code and what's in and what's not in. And I'm just wondering, what's the bill path if this passes today?
Right, and I asked my staff that question last night because of all those references, and my understanding is it's not scheduled to make a stop there. But, you know, I'm going to save Representative Lesch's motion because I think we just need to lay this over, Representative Lehman, and before it passes out of this committee, we really need to address the background check issues and who's going to enforce that piece of it. And with that, were there any other member questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine are all related to background checks, so if someone's going to be working on it, I just want to say I want to be actively involved in the background checks information about where they're going to land or what's going to happen.
Representative Lehman, are you amenable to that?
Madam Chair, yes, we are. We would like to and I appreciate Representative Lucero's comments. They were my comments as well. This is a disruptive technology, and we're seeing it in a lot of different industries. I think this is a good bill. It needs to happen. We need to make it easier for businesses like this to serve Minnesotans. So I'm not hearing, maybe other than the taxi cabs, I'm not hearing people just blatantly wanting Lyft and Uber and these services to go away. We want these services. So we just have to make sure that we cannot constrain them to the degree where they cannot operate efficiently, but help them move forward. So, yes, I am open to having it laid over, and I hope that we can continue on our path to get this bill moving and accomplish this year.
And Representative Lehman, we'll take this up Thursday right away. So,
Madam Chair, if I could also say, we are addressing, we've talked with Commerce and looking at who should be the regulatory agency. There's other issues that were brought up today, and we are scheduling a stakeholder meeting that will happen either at the end of this week or the first part of next week.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we're bringing it up Thursday, we should have that stakeholder meeting before Thursday.
Right. So I don't have a problem. I don't know if other committee members do or not, but at least the pieces that apply to this committee need to be fixed by Thursday before we take it up again. If that's not done by then we'll, you know, we'll have to wait till next week. But to get it out of this committee, that's going to have to happen. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thanks. All right. With that, House File 3032 is laid over, as amended, is laid over. Representative Lean. Good morning, Representative Lean. Welcome to the Civil Law Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. I appreciate hearing my bill today. It is House File 2601. I do have a quick author's amendment for the bill I'd like to take up.
All right. Representative Hillstrom, would you like to move House File 2601, and the motion would be that it be go to the General Register?
I would, Madam Chair.
All right. So, Representative Lean, to your A1.
All right. Thank you, members. The A1 amendment simply changes the enactment date on the last page of the bill, page 3, line 7, changing 2017 to 2018. I drafted the bill last year, hearing it this year.
Very fine. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hilstrom's going to move the A1. All those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
All right. Amendment has been applied. Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, House File 2601, would impact background studies for parents who are guardians or conservators of adult children with developmental disabilities. Under current law, these parents must undergo background studies every 2 years if their child was put into an out-of-home care setting as a minor. However, if the child lived with the parents up until the time they turned 18, no background study is needed. This bill would eliminate the requirement for the background study unless counsel appointed for the proposed ward or protected person recommends it. The concept for the bill was brought to me by my constituent who is here with us today, Pam White. Pam has two adult twin daughters with developmental disabilities. One of her daughters lived in her home until adulthood, and she does not have to have a background study done for continuing to be the guardian of this daughter. Her other daughter was put into an out-of-home care setting as a minor, and because of that, she now has to have a background study done to continue as the guardian for her daughter. And Pam White is here with me today, as I said, and she does have some comments on her story.
Very good. Thank you for being with us this morning. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, I'm Pam White, and thank you for letting me testify. I am the parent of three grown children, a son who's 33 and two twin special needs daughters who are now 25 years old. I'm currently required by the state to have a background study done on me every 2 years so that I can continue to be the guardian of one of my daughters. I believe that this requirement, and I think that, Representative Lean just alluded to that, was that one of my daughters left home at the age of 15 to go into corporate foster care. She was placed in that setting after my husband had passed away, and I found that without his help, I was no longer able to adequately take care of her with all the needs that she required during her daily living activities and the needs that she required during the nighttime hours. The background study is done in addition to me having to petition the court every year to continue to be her guardian. I'm not required to have a background study done on me for my second special needs daughter because she her needs weren't as severe and she stayed in my home until she was about 20 years old. I first learned I needed to have a background study done when I received a court order to appear in court in the fall of 2014. Evidently, I was past due in filing the necessary papers for background study. My daughter Elizabeth had been living out of my home for over 6 years at that time, and no one had told me about the requirements of getting a background study. I then contacted my attorney, who had always handled my guardianship legal issues for my daughters, so that she could take care of the legal documents. I was very concerned about the court order, because I was, and still am, very much a rule follower to a fault, and being summoned to court was totally out of my realm. I also thought that there was a mistake because at that time, in 2014, not only had I been Elizabeth's mother for the past 22 years, but I had also been her legal guardian since November of 2009. At that time, I had already petitioned the court annually for the past 5 years to continue to be her guardian. I found that the expense of having legal counsel was becoming cost prohibitive, not only for one child, but especially for two, so my lawyers, paralegal, showed me how to take care of the legal forms from that point on. It was at that time, about October 2014, that I began contacting my state representatives, Representative Lean and Senator Eakin, to see if they could pursue having that statute revisited during the legislative session. I then told them that I was widowed, a single parent, and guardian of twins with special needs, and that I was concerned about having to get a background study every 2 years in order to remain the guardian of one of my daughters. I felt then, as I do now, that the statute should be rewritten to include a clause or addendum to allow for exceptions which would pertain to circumstances that occur as in my case. I have been the parent to my daughters now for well over 25 years and guardian to my daughters since 2009 for Elizabeth and 2010 for Kelsey, and I had never been questioned about my parenting capabilities and or skills for either daughter, or for that matter for my son, who's now 33. No one in the social service system, the public school system, and the medical or legal systems had ever questioned me about how I had parented my children in the past, So I wondered why the state required a background study on me at all. I had taught hundreds of children in the public school systems for the past 37 years, and I was never required to get a background study. But now I'm required to get one to continue overseeing the needs of one of my twin daughters. I'm a qualified parent for one of the children, but yet I'm not one for the other. And that makes absolutely no sense to me. I thought a background study only indicates whether you have broken laws, so I was wondering how does that show what kind of parent or guardian I am. And I feel that my understanding was with a background study that it indicates whether you've broken any laws, and I have found as an instructor in the public school system, and I came across many parents who probably didn't break any laws, but yet they were very unfit as parents. When I contacted the Department of Human Services to see if this was a continued requirement for me back in the summer of 2016, the people I talked to weren't sure, so they kept passing me up the system until I talked to the deputy director. And it was during that process, there were several people who had indicated to me that they thought it made no sense that I was having to get a background study. And it was also suggested to me that I talk to the county clerk of court, explain my circumstances, and see if I could get exempt from having to do that background study. I also had talked to my former legal counsel about it, and they suggested that I contact my representatives and see if they could change or amend that law so that there would be no future questions or concerns into the law and its interpretation. I found that this law only adds more financial burden and emotional stress to me. I understand that should I leave the state for even a couple of months during the winter, that I would be penalized further by having to get a fingerprint check, and then my costs would go up. I don't understand how leaving the state would make me more of a risk of being a better guardian. I also can understand why background checks and studies are important for people who work with my daughter, since staff come and go fairly frequently, and I would want to know if the staff were sex or drug offenders or previously abused children and are vulnerable adults. The people I've talked to have all thought that it's quite unnecessary that I get this. They actually think it's ridiculous, as do I. I think time and money would be better spent on getting children out of homes where there's abuse or neglect. And in closing, I would like your committee to give a closer look as to how this statute is written and what the actual intent is of this statute. And I think allowances should be made for parents like me who have proved that they're good parents and good guardians, and I don't think that we should have that added burden of having to get a background study. And I also feel that since I am already required yearly to have a to petition the court to be their guardian, I don't understand how the background study is even necessary. So thank you for listening to me.
Thank you, Ms. White. I really appreciate you coming all this way to testify. Are there member questions? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify in this bill? Seeing no one. Representative Lean. Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 2601, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you so much for being
Thank
here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Our final bill for the day is Representative O'Neill, House File 3017. There she is. Representative O'Neill, we're ready for your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot going on today. Sorry.
That's all right. That's all right. Would you like to move your bill? And the motion would be that it go to HHS reform.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 3017 be re-referred to HHS reform.
Thank you. Go ahead with to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm very happy to bring this bill to you this morning. This is a work product of a couple years, about a year and a half, of a multidisciplinary group organized by MnCASA and funded by OJP
And what it is addressing is the backlog and looking prospectively also at the rape kits. And so, you know, we had done a study about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe it was 3 years ago. I believe Representative Schoen, when he was still here, presented a bill, did a study to see how many rape kits had not been tested. And the number came back at 3,482 kits, which seems like a lot until you delve in to see why those were not tested. So the study did that and looked at why they were not tested. The working group actually looked at how do we make sure that this doesn't happen again. And so this is a very good framework to how do we do this looking forward. So the time frames and the kit handling. But the most important thing, what we're going to talk about today, is the information sharing to the victim. And so I'm going to turn it over to Mincasa to tell you about that portion of it, because we have been through public safety. And as you just mentioned, with re-referral here, we'll be going to HHS policy. So I'll let Carolyn Palmer from Mincasa talk about specifically the information for the victim.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the Public and Legal Affairs Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. We're a statewide coalition that has about 70 sexual assault programs all around pretty much almost every county here in the state. I want to thank Representative O'Neill for her leadership on this particular legislation and to point out that the group that we had in place was funded by the Office of Justice Programs at the Department of Public Safety. It was a number of different stakeholders, many of whom are here today, from law enforcement, from county attorneys, advocacy, and medical, everybody coming together to talk about how best we can approach this issue. As Representative O'Neill mentioned, I'm going to really focus on the victim notification piece today, but just to very briefly say the rest of the bill talks about processes for handling kits between hospitals and law enforcement, and the piece we're addressing is what happens when a victim wants to find out where their information is. One thing we've learned from what's happened in our state and from states all over the country is sometimes victims feel like they have a kit done. It's a very invasive process, and then they're not sure what happens to it. What this does within this bill is set up a way so that the victim can find out where their kit is in the process. So essentially what we have here is a deadline that law enforcement agencies need to abide by of 30 days. They will set up a process, and a victim can access that process and ask the law enforcement agency to give them information about where their kit is. It might be still sitting with the law enforcement agency. It could be at the crime lab getting tested. It might be back again in the law enforcement agency. All the victim can find out through this process is where the kit is and whether or not a DNA profile was found, but not any details about the DNA profile or any other investigation details. We also have set up a way for the victim to designate someone else, such as a sexual assault advocate, to be able, in their stead, to find out data on the victim's behalf. And this is really helpful if a victim may be homeless, in shelter, in somewhere else where they're not easily accessible and by contact through law enforcement. The other thing we have is a process here that allows an agency to set up a process to help a victim kind of basically convert their kit from a restricted kit to an unrestricted kit. And all that really means, earlier in the proposed bill, we have some definitions. A restricted kit is a kit in which the victim has not decided whether or not she or he wants to submit it to law enforcement at that point. And under our state law and also the Violence Against Women Act, victims have that choice. If they do decide they want to actually release it, it becomes an unrestricted kit. So there's a process here for agencies to make that conversion. One other piece to be aware of, it's on lines 328 to 329. And it talks about instances in which an agency may be able to refuse that data if they believe it will interfere with the investigation. This is similar language to other parts of the statutes that have to deal with criminal data. So this is consistent. Within our work group, we have worked very closely with law enforcement and prosecutors, the ones who may be making these decisions. Their impression, and again, we always know there are exceptions, but their impression is this is data that highly likely would be released in most cases to victims. It's not very extensive data. It's data they may already be sharing anyway to let the victim know where their case is in process.
But, you know, I just wanted to acknowledge that there may be questions about that, and we are consistent with other sections of statute. But we also recognize there may be a bigger conversation to be had about victim access to data in general, about criminal cases, and that's certainly something we're open to in other contexts. Thank you.
Thank you for that. That was one of the questions I had reading through the bill. Any member questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? All right, speak now, forever hold your peace, I guess, till the next committee, right? with that, members, seeing no further questions, Representative O'Neill renews her motion that House File 3017 as, oh no, there was no amendment, that House File 3017 be re-referred to the Committee on HHS Reform. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you so much for being here. Members? There's a very high likelihood that we will be having an evening hearing on Thursday. So you have been duly warned. With that, members, we are adjourned.